So today is Wednesday, April 13th, 2011. I'm Rick Hansen, and tonight I'd like to talk about dukkha. Dukkha is the Buddhist term, or technically it's a term in Pali. Pali is a language that was the in which the earliest surviving written records of Buddhism were written in. So in terms of Pali, the word dukkha is loosely translated and frequently translated as suffering. So for those of you that have been here routinely, you know that in this year, 2011, I'm wanting to focus kind of thematically on relationships as a field of practice and a support for practice, and also a major source of difficulty, suffering, tension, stress, distress, and so forth. And as we wrap up last year's themes on mindfulness, we have this kind of catch-all category in the Buddha's teachings about the fourth foundation of mindfulness that includes a number of themes. So in that fourth foundation of mindfulness, the fourth thing, as it were, that we should rest our attention upon, where we should establish our attention, right? In that fourth foundation includes the Four Noble Truths. So for example, in previous meetings here, as kind of a two-for-one deal, we've been exploring how to apply various themes inside that fourth foundation of mindfulness to the territory or issue of relationships. So for example, we've applied the hindrances to the notion of relationships. We've also looked at how the aspects or aggregates of experience relate to relationships, particularly if we look at something that's upsetting to us and tease it apart. So this is some of what we've done, and if any of that's interesting to you, you can go back if you like and take a look at the talks in previous weeks. Tonight, I'd like to begin to enter into the Four Noble Truths, which, as the Buddha said, if you know, it was on the basis of deeply, profoundly understanding these four truths that he achieved his own liberation. And he said repeatedly, and you should judge for yourself whether you think this makes sense, he said repeatedly that someone who has deeply penetrated, who has thoroughly penetrated to the essence of the Four Noble Truths, will achieve enlightenment in this lifetime. So the Four Noble Truths are very important, at least in Buddhism. They're the truth of suffering, broadly defined, very broadly defined. The truth of the cause of suffering, which in Buddhist psychology or Buddhist teaching is seen as craving, again, broadly defined. Third, the truth of the ending of suffering, which is the ending of craving. And fourth, the path, the truth of the path leading to the end of craving that eradicates suffering, which is to say the Noble Eightfold Path. That's the fourth noble truth. Okay? It may seem a little complicated, but I think this is fairly familiar to most of us. In other words, if you take ordinary human experience, like I'm dealing with something in my larger family system, actually. I won't go into the gory details, but I'm experiencing a little suffering and tension and distress and pangs and hurt and irritation, whatever, the usual stuff around it. Think about the person who opened this room here for us, the suffering she experienced racing down here, frustrated in traffic, you know, worried about the consequences of her not getting here on time to open up the building for us. Think about ordinary quarrels or contentiousness or tension in relationships. Anybody in this room ever experienced tension in relationships? Okay, a little irritation, a little anxiety, a little feeling hurt, feeling let down, or worried. Maybe we love others. We worry about what happens to them, both those that we're very close to, or if we worry about what happens to people far away. I was just watching CNN briefly last night, and there was a piece in it about dogs who live around the reactor site area. Even though the people have left, the dogs are still there. The rescue workers and so forth will sometimes come upon a dog that's chained to a stake who hasn't eaten for 2 weeks. You know, and then what's that like? Right there, I can see people wounded by that. You know, suffering we feel vicariously when we care about others. This is very human, the truth of that, as well as really anguishing forms of physical and emotional suffering, sometimes related to what the Buddha called three of the four divine messengers, old age, disease, and death. Right? So suffering is real. And the Buddha was very gripped by the matter of human suffering and what to do about it, particularly in terms of the ultimates. He was really interested in what led to freedom from suffering, so that one could have a human life. That was the middle way in Buddhism, not detached from the world ascetically and withdrawn, nor swept away in the conventional life. And he has had as good a conventional life as anyone could in his time. He was wealthy, he was good looking, he had high status, he was brilliant, he had all the pleasures any young prince in northern India in his day could ever have. And even that, at the end of it all, is like, okay? So how do we get to that kind of freedom? Well, I want to explore that with you with regard to relationships. So here we have these Four Noble Truths, right? The truth of suffering, and then the notion that what really drives suffering is thirst, which is the root of the word craving. Grasping for or grasping against, that's what gets us to suffer. And that craving comes from three fundamental sources. First, the ordinary craving that we experience when something happens that we don't like at all or we really like. In other words, ordinary wanting. The second source of the craving that leads to suffering in the Buddhist model is the craving of past lives that set us up for rebirth yet again in a life that has a body that will experience a significant amount of inescapable discomfort, physical and emotional discomfort. You don't have to buy into that notion of previous lives, but it's totally embedded in early Buddhist cosmology. And then the third source, which is what I'm really particularly going to focus in tonight, is the subtlety of inevitable discomfort that arises in relationships, and how do we then react to that basic discomfort in relationships. The ending of this particular kind of suffering is to not react to the suffering in the first place. So let me explain what I mean by that. You've probably noticed, I've been myself reflecting more and more upon it, that in relationships, even with really nice people, fairly mature, in their practice, with love, I'm thinking of my family, right? Or with other people in general. Nice people, ordinary good people, there are always these little misunderstandings or these little moments where you feel not fully met, right? Not utterly tuned into or perfectly responded to, right? Or there's some little disagreement or some little, you worry internally, did I do something wrong? Was I a little too moving in, or was I a little too detached, right? Did I lead too much with head, or did I get lost too much in heart, right? It's these little things. Or we try to read the other person, and we can't perfectly read them. And so then we feel like we don't exactly know what's going on over there, which creates sometimes a kind of tension. And I'm not talking about, because I grew up to some extent in this world in my early adulthood, I'm not talking about some kind of crazy, Esalen, New Age, it's got to be perfect attunement 24/7 sort of thing. I'm talking about ordinary stuff. There you are at the market, and you can't get your credit card thing or your debit card to work quickly enough, and you start feeling kind of funny, like people are standing in line behind you, and the line's getting longer, and they're starting to look at you, or you're wondering if they're looking at you, or you're wondering if the checking person is looking at you, looking at them, or whatever it is, Or you, right? Or a lot of this sort of subtle stuff is kind of imaginary, like, what if my card is refused? What kind of embarrassment will I feel? Why would my card be refused? What has my son done with my card? Right? This is very, very, very common when we bring our awareness to it. Little anxiety. What about that little funny apprehension or unease we get around people? Like, do you like me? How am I doing? Is this making sense? How am I being evaluated? I don't just so much mean me right now, although I could mean it that way, but I mean just in life, right? In workplaces, dating. I'm a therapist, you may know, and I have clients sometimes who are going back out into the dating world in midlife, and you know, like my Match.com profile, is it good? What will people think? And, you know, and then you go out on these first encounters with people, and do you like me? Are you going to like me? I like you more than you like me, or what a nightmare. Or you like me more than I like you, what a nightmare. You know, they're just, right? There's all this little stuff. And I think of the meaning of the root of the word dukkha in Buddhism. Some of you have heard me say this, du and ka, dukkha. And du means, not good, right? It's not a moralistic thing. It's sort of like, not good, not right, not so forth. And ka is where the axle meets the hub of a wheel. It's kind of a wobbly grinding. It's not quite right. You know, it's not horrible. It's not a forest fire. It's not, you know, a building collapsing. But it's this wobbly grinding, right? The everyday wobbly grinding of relationships. I'm hearing some knowing chuckles. So can you help me out here a little bit? Like, can you think of some examples of this kind of everyday tension or everyday subtle stress or apprehension or unease or not longing? Think of the longing in the heart to be known, to be fully met, and how rarely that longing is, that wholesome longing, is probably completely fulfilled. And then if it's fulfilled, the related anxiety, when will this end? When will this end? Okay, any examples or elaborations of what I'm talking about or questions about it so far? Tom, yeah.
How about officer, why did you pull me over?
Great, right, exactly. That's right there. Tension in power structures. There you are in a situation where you're one down, right? You're being bossed around maybe or directed or corrected. You know, maybe you're on the receiving end of people, given the distinction between intent and impact. Their intent is good, but the impact is that they're irritated, right? They're helping you, right? They're helping you understand. My mother is very loving, and she communicated love a lot by helping you relentlessly become a better person. And so she could tell the difference between a quarter and a nickel at 200 yards, you know, that kind of thing. She could tell the thing that wasn't quite right. And she was distressed until she found the thing that wasn't quite right, which then she could help you with. All right? So you're on, right? So you're with someone who you know until she finds it. She's like a dog searching for the bone, right? And then when she finds it, then too, there's this thing. And then you think, oh, do I tell her about it? Annoying. You know, right? Right? This stuff. Or the stuff that's triggered from our past. We haven't even talked about that, right? Our past with a particular person, our past with authority figures, let's say that's a police officer, or our past with our mother, our father, our kids, you know, or they say that word, or they do that subtle thing, and you just can, oh my God, the whole history around that. You know, my wife and I have a 23-year-old and a 20-year-old, and each of them can do or say something that just very subtle or small, and it will bring up, hey, you know, in subtle ways, but real ways, you know, internal winces at the mistakes every parent makes. Okay. So, any other examples? Yeah, another Tom here. Two Toms so far. Yeah.
I was just talking about, last week we talked about doubt as one of the four or five hindrances. It seems like a lot of dukkha is made up of doubt.
Yeah, can you say, give me a concrete example maybe?
Well, I'll just call it free-floating anxiety or insecurity of walking through life. You know, some of the things you talked about, of doubting oneself, doubting how one is operating in the world, decisions, words, whatever. It just seems that it occurred to me when you were talking about dukkha, suffering, like a lot of suffering has its roots in doubt.
Yeah. And doubt itself feels unpleasant, doesn't it? Do that subtle unease. What's my standing with you? You know, that drives that looking for reassurance, Do you know that feeling, pulling for reassurance? No? No one knows what I'm pulling, right? See, yeah, there I was, pulling for reassurance. Right there, live, on Wednesday night in San Rafael. How about another example or two? Yeah, great. Yeah. Or again, you think of the, like if I could play off that slightly, the tension or dukkha that comes up when we encounter a mind stream different, that seems at odds with our own. You know, I've been really struck by being in workshops at Spirit Rock, let's say leading a workshop, and with very mature people, generally speaking, in terms of the distribution of, let's say, personal practice, just frankly, emotional intelligence, definitely at the average of that group in that room is way out toward the high end of the spectrum. And these are people who have really practiced loving kindness, they're very serious about it, and they're great until you mention Dick Cheney, right? Because they're fairly progressive on the average of Spirit Rock, and then suddenly there's that, you know? There I am watching television, given my own politics, and someone like Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin or Rush Limbaugh starts talking, and it's really interesting to watch the tension in the body that starts happening. They don't know who I am. They're not talking to me. I'm not psychotic. By the way, if you think they're talking to you personally, you need it. But no. But guess what? We get that riled up. Yes. You know? Okay. Maybe one more. One more. Great. Right there. Oh, I love that. So there you are. Something happens. There's a reaction to it. And then we react to our reaction to the thing that happened. And there we are. Which is actually a good lead-in, if I could, to the now the point here. For me, it's been, you know, I've been practicing a while. So it's great when you stumble upon something and you go, wow, this is new. This is really good. So maybe this new thing for me was an old thing for some of you. But to realize the subtlety of the inherent dukkha in life, in relationships, and you know, the subtle tensions, let's say, just for relationships, and then to realize that I didn't have to react to that dukkha. Because normally what the organism does, and this is how we're wired biologically, is we feel some distress or some tension or some anxiety, some apprehension, some doubt, some unease of some kind, some conflict between our values and those of others, let's say. And the inner iguana, the inner monkey, the inner rat, the inner caveman, cavewoman wants to react. Our ancestors who were this la-di-da about anxiety or anger or feeling one down and so forth, or feeling cast out from the group or some at oddsness with other people in the band, the ancestors that just, like I said, were la-di-da about it, they didn't live to see the sunrise. You know, very often they failed a fundamental test in the wild, which is to eat lunch, not be lunch, right? So, anyway, we want to react. But if we react, if we have dukkha about our dukkha, right? Dukkha, it's called. If we suffer that, we suffer. If we get angry or reactive because there's a tension between us and another person, or there's an unease in our body. If we react to our reaction, then the snowballing cascade begins. And the very interesting, and for me, has been kind of radical process that's an alternative to that, is to simply be mindful of the first start, the Buddha called it, the first dukkha, the initial and inevitable dukkha, and not get agitated that something isn't quite right, interpersonal. Like hypothetically, mom shows up and she says, I'm sorry, it's raining. And these reactions arise in us, right, that are dukkha for us. The option then is simply just go, dukkha is inevitable. Sometimes we get offended that there's dukkha. I shouldn't feel this tension, right? There shouldn't be this sense of distance sort of, you know, between us. Or I shouldn't have this anger at you. Or I shouldn't feel so hurt or excluded. But instead, if we can just let it be, and in fact, gradually unpack that inherent subtlety of tension, stress, distress, that's inherent, I think, in relationships. It's inescapable. If we can quit resisting the fact that there is a fair amount of subtle tension, wobbly grinding in relationships, then we're free. What happens, interestingly, if you look closely, if you deconstruct the experience of that first dukkha, that tension, the subtlety of unease, you actually just be with the sensations of it in the body and just be with the emotions of it, just the thoughts of it, and kind of then the craving that's in it or starting to emerge around it. You just be with all that and unpack it. It, a really weird and interesting thing happens. It stops being dukkha. Wild. If you really step into the tension, the distress, the weirdness, and really unpack it, the sensations remain, but it's not a problem anymore. It's not uncomfortable anymore. It's just like this. You know, it's just an experience.
The first.
Yeah. But the radical thing, you see for yourself. If you just kind of explore, what does this tension feel like between me and this other person? Or what is this anxiety like in my body, the subtle unease, you know? Or there is this longing here for more closeness with my teenager.
Well, that actually feels kind of good. You did. It's the second arc that's been all
that. It's really interesting, isn't it? So I really would like your comments about this.
It seems to me that in my experience, awareness gets knowing what is going on, it's recognizing that I'm suffering dukkha in that moment, or else I will go for that second error, I will react to what I'm really not quite aware of that I'm suffering. Does that make any sense?
Totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think the first thing is to realize that you really is to track that particularly the, it's kind of like wallpaper suffering. You know, it's just there with us and with other people. These, you know, it's being aware of it, and then at second, it's being okay with it. Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that in my experience, when I resist the chaos, it just gets lost.
Super well said. Just what I mean. It's like really the invitation here is in important relationships or in relationships in general. First, it's to actually acknowledge a layer maybe of discomfort or tension, or subtle unease, or apprehension, or frustration that's really there and hasn't really been acknowledged. But it's sort of like the nasty swamp that breeds more conspicuous forms of suffering and interpersonal conflict. Is that clear? Okay, good. You mean an event happens with someone?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think that's a great example. Just novelty. Again, in the Serengeti, as we evolved, novelty was dangerous. You know, like a new thing could be a bad thing. There's a Spanish proverb, you may know it, let no new thing arise. Thank you. I appreciate what you're saying here. I think you're totally right. It's deep. In other words, rather than letting it be what it is, right, we try to explain it away. Yeah. I would include it, you know, rather than just simply letting the situation be what it is, including our experience of it. Sometimes we try to, as you say, explain it away or create a story about it, which then just makes things worse. Yeah. It's a great question. To me, that's the ongoing question, especially for Buddhism, you know. And what's there for me about that is, first, is to ask myself, how much allowing is there of the discomfort that's here for me, right off the top? And most of us are not erring on the side of too much allowing of discomfort, right? And again, as you said and other people have said, we're resisting the discomfort, right? Or we're trying to do something about it. Rather than accept a fair amount of it as just inevitable and inherent. You know, it's sort of like friction, you know, of life. That's part one. Part two, you know, we don't talk, I do intend to talk more about this year, but I find what comes up in my response to what you're saying is to explore sometimes what we're guided by is love, even with someone that we're having a conflict with. You know, is there some guidance here that comes from love inside oneself, inside you, inside me? You know? And I think another thing is a willingness to say what's true. I think that's first and foremost. You know, as a therapist, as someone. You know, who grew up in the 60s and 70s, it's the willingness to name what's true.
But when you say what's true, that's your opinion.
Yeah.
That's the other person thinks the opposite. So, I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, it is what I think is true, there's no way out of the fact that they think what they think is true, I think what I think is true. But I think there, what I mean by what's true is, for example, when you say that, or when you agree to come home by 6 and you don't night after night, I feel X, Y, and Z. Certainly the truth of my own experience. That's more what I mean. Or the truth that, let's say, you're with someone, or the truth, my mom again. You know, it's easy to talk about someone who's no longer alive, but anyway, no. You know, my mom, when we had kids, she talked about almost nothing but how we could become better parents. And having my own thoughts about how she could have been a better parent, I wasn't that interested in her counsel, and nor especially was my wife. And after a while, I said to my mom, Mom, I have a request. Which is that from now on, unless I specifically ask for it, that you never express a judgment or advice about how we raise our kids. She said, I don't do that. I said, great, then there won't be a problem. And then I just hung out with her. I remember vividly doing this in the den of our house in Southern California. And I watched her, and because that's almost entirely what she did, she would start to say something, Then she would remember what I had just said to her, and she would catch herself. Because the truth is that she did do that a lot. You know, so, but to go to your point, I think, my own opinion here, if we speak our truth with persuasive intent, it's a yellow flag. Because most of the time, I think what really works is to speak our truth for our own sake. It's okay to try to say it with some persuasive intent, you know, or to try to create some solution. But if we move too far away, if we move very far away from speaking our truth for ourselves, we're in trouble. Because then the result is contingent on what that other person does. And it's interesting, you know, when you're on the receiving end of someone who's trying to jam their truth into you or get you to agree with them or to see it differently or to buy into their version of reality, there's a certain amount of resistance to that, isn't there? But on the other hand, when people with great dignity just sort of call it like they see it and you're going to do what you do with that, that has a lot of power, doesn't it? There's a lot of gravity. Yeah, that's right. You're speaking for yourself. So, yeah, no, it was great. That was great. Yeah. Yeah. Attach, yeah. Oh, that's great, yeah. That's great. Hey, I invite you right now, if you know, take 30, 60 seconds, we'll just be quiet, I'll do it with you. And I suggest that you bring to mind an important relationship where there is some tension, let's say, or distress or frustration on your part, at least. Maybe awkwardness. And amidst maybe lots of love or other things, but at least there's some real, there's stuff there. And then see if you can identify, maybe just gently name to yourself, some of the underlying tension or distress or stress for you. And then see what it would be like to allow those aspects of your experience to more just be there and not react to them so much. I had kind of an insight earlier today about this person I'm grappling with that I have really longed for what in psych language is narcissistic supplies from this person. I really longed for prizing. I really longed for the feeling that I really matter to this person. It's okay. It's normal stuff, kind of rooted in my own childhood wounds. And I got, wow, if I could just be with that longing, which has dukkha in it, right, without reacting to that longing, or without being so distressed that that longing is not fulfilled, then I wouldn't be creating difficulty in this relationship. Anyway, see what happens. So just imagine, if you can, a key relationship and track an underlying kind of quality of subtle tension or imbalance or wobbly grinding, and then see what would happen for you if you really just sort of let that wobbly grinding be there in your experience without getting reactive around it. Okay, you feel free to keep reflecting. Yeah, how about some comments? We have about five more minutes and we'll wrap up. Yeah. Did the what see? See? Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh. She's talking about a teleseminar, and it has a number of speakers, and I was broadcast today. Not original to me, but anyway, keep going. I'm just the messenger. Totally. Thank you for bringing that up. I think you said it right there, the want perfection. We have this idea that it's not supposed to be this way. You know, and if we can let go of that about a certain inevitable, inescapable, you know, low-grade grit. You know, it's like going to sleep in gritty sheets. There's just no way around an irreducible amount of little grit in the sheets in life, right? Anyway, you're right. It's not getting upset that it's there. Just like Tom said, yeah. I think that's right. Including our attitude. I think sometimes, you know, we have this attitude of we're trying to, that stuff shouldn't be there. Or it means something alarming that it is there. Right? Instead of, it's there it is. Yeah, leave. Well, exactly. It's localizing the dukkha in here. You know, yeah, events are bumping into us, but where it's happening is here. And most of the causes that make us have this subtle tension or anxiety or subtle irritation are over here. Maybe, yeah, another person or two, and then we'll wrap up. Yeah. Great, yeah.
Yeah, so the manipulation probably has a lot of history. And probably if I wanted to, I could either let go of it, or if I want to, I can turn around with my manipulation has shown up.
Yeah.
Or I can let it go.
That's great. That's great. And can you tolerate, just like you said, the experience of manipulation? You know, and then the artist, and Dara's getting at it, is what happens, I think, is that we really, and I've experienced this many times, I'm sure we all have many times, we are surrounded with spacious awareness, we get what it is, we feel free. We actually are no longer, we're not reacting to the grip. We're not in reactive mode. you know, this distinction I've made between the reactive mode and the responsive mode of the brain. We're actually not in reactive mode. And because we're not in reactive mode and there is a spaciousness, we see clearly what would be helpful, at least, or consistent with our values. And then we act accordingly. You know, we take action based on our values and our virtues rather than our emotional, stressful reactions to things. Yeah.
Someone was telling me a story, and the story was more like telling me how gifted he was and talented he was, and it was more like bragging, and it went on and on and on and on. And this is a new relationship. And finally I said to this person, when do I get a chance to talk? This person got up and went.
It worked. No. Keep
going. But I have to say that's not the whole story, because I said, well, I don't understand why you're leaving, and I really like you. And he said, I like you too, but I'm leaving. Oh, but before he left, he said, could I have a little of the chicken soup that you made for dinner? And he didn't want to miss out on it. I did not give him the chicken. But after thinking about it, I decided that I really liked him. So I called him up. He's like a first class pianist, and he teaches jazz. And I said, I'd like to take some jazz class with you. I said, okay. And then I knew the next day he was going to be in the same place as this happened today. And it was a funny story. I brought him the chicken soup. And I think he liked it, and he said, I'll have it for dinner tonight.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. Great.
Isn't that a funny thing?
Yeah.
Because time lapsed, and then I thought, and then he must have thought.
Yeah.
So, a funny thing.
That's great. And, you know, just to maybe wrap up on that, and then we can sit for a minute. The distinction I'm kind of making here is between micro-dukkha and macro-dukkha, right? Macro-dukkha is you're driving in the freeway and, you know, something happens and someone flips you the bird, right? Or you get a phone call that your kid's in trouble, or someone is really alarming to you, or you get dumped in a relationship, or you decide to break up from the other person, whatever it is. You know, you decide to leave. That's macro dukkha, right? Okay. What I'm talking about is that little stuff, and then how we react to that little stuff. Just to be clear, that's what I've been talking about. And so my suggestion to you, if you like this week, is to see what it's like to try to be more tolerant of, more spacious around, less disturbed by, you know, less offended by micro dukkha. Is that clear as a suggestion?
Yeah.
So it's being aware of it, because a lot of it we don't quite, it's more in the background, you know, and then we act upon it. I'm talking about being more aware of the subtlety of tension or unfulfillment or not feeling well understood or wondering what's going on in the mind of the other person or whatever it is, okay? Or feeling a little brushed aside or manipulated or pushed around, that little subtle stuff. Being aware of it, and then second, being spacious around it. Not so much reacting to it. And seeing what happens in your own experience if you just sort of let it be the case. Sort of let it be there. Okay? That's relatively good. Okay, great. How about we sit for a minute? Let this kind of sink in. In other words, allowing and including the subtle tension that life is heir to. No way around it, really. And not trying to resist it or struggle with it or solve it. Simply letting it be there and air out, unpack in spacious awareness. Thank you for your practice.